Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, my name is Chrissy Champagne. You are listening to Residue, a true crime podcast dedicated to keeping you paranoid. Residue is not just another true crime podcast, but a necessary tool for those who want to understand the dangers lurking in the real world. And as you guys might already know, we are now switching up the format for Residue. We're niching down. We are going to concentrate on movies, made-for-TV movies or theatrical releases that were inspired by true crimes. And then I will tell you the true story behind that film. You know that Residue is created, hosted, written, researched, edited, and produced by me, Chrissy Champagne. I'm doing it all by myself here, guys, so thank you so much for joining me. You can also join me on Instagram at Residue Podcast, Facebook, Residue A True Crime Podcast, or TikTok at Residue Podcast. And as I always say, the best thing you could possibly do for any podcast that you love is leave a 5-star review. Okay, so the same song has been on my mind all day today, and it kind of rhymes with residue. It's Xanadu, Xanadu, now you are here, so follow residue, residue, your neon lights. I could go on for this entire episode, just sing Olivia Newton-John songs for you, if you want. Or we could talk about the made-for-television film Face Value, the Marla Hanson story, because I know so many of you have been DMing me to make a TikTok video about that story. So I thought, let's also make a podcast episode, because how much did that movie traumatize you as a kid, watching Cheryl Pollack play Marla Hanson? And one more thing real quick before we get to the story. So I know a couple of weeks ago I asked everyone to DM me, send me some ideas for names for the Residue listeners. And I just went with Resicrew because, you know, you guys are like the coolest crew ever. I just have to give a shout out because I got a DM this week. I got a lot of DMs actually with a lot of brilliant and witty names. Thank you all so much. I wanted to give a shout out because I got a DM from Tay. I won't say their last name, but Tay wrote to me and said the name Residudes. I think it's brilliant. And I feel like it just kind of flows, mainly because I also just call everyone dude. But I want to know what you guys think. Let me know. I love Residue. I love Residudes. I just love all of you. So now that we've taken care of all the business, we're about to get into the Marla Hanson story. And as you know, listener discretion is advised. The Marla Hanson story, also titled Face Value, is a 1991 made-for-television drama film that originally aired on NBC on February 4th, 1991. Now, this is a true story based on the real-life assault of Marla Hanson, a young aspiring model whose face was slashed in a brutal attack arranged by her former landlord. And the movie follows her traumatic experience and her pursuit of justice. Cheryl Pollack plays Marla Hanson and Dale Midkiff plays Eric Warner, a photographer and love interest in the movie. Kirk Baltz plays Steve Roth, the villain of the film. And you guys know that if there is one thing that we love here at Residue, it is a Dale Midkiff movie. We don't generally always love Dale in every part he plays, though. And we love it more than people on Rotten Tomatoes did because this movie only got a 20% Rotten Tomatoes score. I looked through a few reviews about this movie, and here is one that I found on Letterboxd. And now, this was from a user named No Personality. They wrote, "If you like made-for-TV stalking stories, you'll like this. And I don't think acting quality, poor Cheryl Pollack, will deter you in any way. I checked out, sadly, during any scene with Steve and his friends. I'll never understand how these films all at one point turn into Fear, 1996, starring Reese Witherspoon and Mark Wahlberg." Also, by the way, I love the movie Fear. Nicole forever. Okay, so another user named Mac wrote, "A film that has nothing to say beyond condemning violence against women. Unfortunately, the events shown here have probably happened to thousands of women, which is awful, but it also makes the film completely replaceable. I am left wondering why anyone would adapt this story other than to make a buck off of a tragedy. I hope Marla got paid well." So I think for a lot of us, and tell me if I'm wrong, we saw these movies right at a pivotal moment in our lives. Like, most of us were pretty young when we saw these movies. And honestly, like I said earlier, I got so many DMs about this movie, and you know that I am like a made-for-TV movie queen. I completely blocked this one out of my brain. And the minute you guys wrote to me and said Marla Hanson, it was like immediately I could see Cheryl Pollack's face in my head. And I'm like, oh my God, I forgot about the Marla Hanson story. So basically what I'm trying to say is that I feel like if you watched the movie right when it came out on TV in your living room, you'd probably give it a different score than someone who's seeing it for the first time because they don't make them like they used to. Okay, so let's get into the true story behind the made-for-television film. Marla Hanson was born June 18th, 1961 in Independence, Missouri. She had two brothers and in time, she had five half-siblings. So Marla lived with her mother and her stepfather. But as time went on, her biological father, Bob Hanson, he wanted custody of his children. So when Marla was 12, her father took custody, and that is when her and her brothers went to live with him, his wife Dorothy, and then Dorothy's two children. And this was in a small Missouri farm town. This was going to be a complete change for Marla. At only 12 years old, her life is now completely changing. She was living with her mom, who worked in a bowling alley. She had all these half-siblings. Now she goes to her father's house. Her father is more of like a businessman. He worked for IBM. He was always trying to pursue different business ventures to gain more money, to make things better for the family. He really got into real estate at one point. But the one thing that was completely hard for Marla to adjust to was the fact that her father was so religious. He was like consumed by his religion. There was an article in Texas Monthly. It was published January 1993 and written by Jan Reed. Now, this article is a fantastic look into Marla's background. And in it, Jan Reed describes that as Marla is transitioning from her home with her mother to her father's home, it was just so incredibly hard for her to adapt to her father's religious ways of life. And I'm not just talking about like saying a prayer at the dinner table and going to church every Sunday. I mean, like, her father was speaking in tongues, and Marla was finding it very difficult to learn how to speak in tongues. She even states to the journalist that this kind soul took pity on her and other local teens and would teach them different phrases that they could recite. And it was just so that they sounded enough like they were speaking in tongues so that they didn't feel so much pressure. Her father also wouldn't allow her to date anyone unless they were a born-again Christian boy. He also wouldn't allow her to be a cheerleader, which we heard in last week's story, the same situation with Wanda Holloway. He also required that if anybody wanted to take Marla on a date, they had to sit down and have an interview with him first. And Marla ends up laughing about this later and saying nobody would do it. In 1979, Marla goes to college at the Southwestern Assemblies of God College in Waxahachie. Did I say that right? Please tell me I did. So at this college, the co-eds couldn't wear jeans with zippers in front. They couldn't wear shorts or sweatpants, and stockings were required. And Marla and her friends would be rebels with this dress code. They would wear long skirts, hiking boots. They would ignore the time that they had to be back for curfew. And soon she found that she didn't really dig this college experience, and she ended up moving back home. In 1981, Bob Hansen moves his entire family to Austin, Texas, because he wanted to be closer to his parents who were aging. Once he gets to Austin, Texas, Bob finds a job as a photographer for a local newspaper. They also start taking in a lot of foster children. So Marla ends up having to share her home, share her bedroom with all of these strangers. Starting in 1983, Marla went through a lot of different jobs. She was trying out a bunch of different careers. She started off waiting tables, and then she became a receptionist. She also tried to pursue her license to sell financial securities, and then she didn't like doing that. She quit, and then she enrolled in real estate school. And at that same time, she was also working as a cocktail waitress at a bunch of fashionable and hip new spots that were opening. Marla says she wasn't the greatest cocktail waitress. She would spill drinks all the time. I wasn't a great waitress or cocktail waitress either. I could never carry cosmopolitans or martinis on a tray, but I did learn a trick. If you just hum while you're walking and carrying the tray, the drinks won't spill. But Marla was really good at charming all of the wealthy customers, the wealthy men. They would always give her their business cards, and she would keep all of them and tell them, you know, one day I am going to be in real estate, and when I am, I'm going to be giving you a call. Just a natural born networker, which we love. So it's around this time that Marla starts thinking, you know what? I should be a model. And she goes to this modeling agency. She meets with this agent named Kim Dawson. And right away, Kim Dawson is like, you cannot be a model. I wouldn't even waste your time or your money on making a portfolio because, first of all, you are way too short. And second of all, you just don't have the look. You don't have the X factor that we're looking for. But Marla is like, you know what? Screw you, lady. I'm going to do it anyway. Marla starts working at a place called JH Collectibles. Now, this is a fashion firm in the Dallas Apparel Mart. And she was mainly just a sales clerk, but she started learning more about showroom modeling, just mainly things like hats or jewelry. And it wasn't even a paid gig. This was like in exchange for a discount on the clothes that the company sold. So in the summer of 1985, Marla gets offered a transfer to New York City. And she was like, oh my God, hell yeah. She says that she wasn't feeling like her family was really close to her at this point. She didn't really feel like she had any support from them. And this was the perfect opportunity for her to get to the big city and start her modeling career. There is a quote in the Texas Monthly article where Marla states, it was a time to move on. I didn't have any family support. They didn't even come see me. I had no money, no education. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. So you float around and you try to figure it out. I didn't drink. I didn't do drugs, except for ecstasy. I did try that, she says. I think I was pretty tame compared to the people I knew at that time in the 80s, especially the guys. So Marla Hansen heads to the Big Apple, New York City, the place where you can make all of your dreams come true. But when Marla arrived in 1985, she said, oh my God, I hate this place. And you know what? I gotta tell you, I also did the same thing, not in 1985. It was more like 1998. But yeah, I didn't dig it either. just, I wasn't prepared for how expensive it was going to be. And Marla says the same thing. She just wasn't prepared for how much it cost to actually live your life in New York City. And I'm seeing a lot of similarities here between Marla's experience in New York City and mine. And now she was only making $25,000 a year at this job working as a sales clerk at JH Collectibles. And there's no way you're going to be able to get by in New York City making $25,000 a year, not even in 1985. So she's going to have to get another job. And she does work in a bar at night. And she also starts thinking, oh, maybe I should just go back to Dallas, but I don't want to be looked upon as a loser. I don't want to be crawling back to Dallas saying that I wasn't able to do this. Now, while Marla's trying to work her ass off just to survive, she's not really paying attention to the fact that three different times, while only in New York for a short time, it's only like been a month that she's been there, she's already been stopped on the street by different photographers handing her their business cards and saying, oh my God, you're gorgeous. I'd love to photograph you. But she just took it as like, men suck. Men are always sucking and they're just hitting on me constantly. She just thought, these are just men. They're not really photographers. But at this time, she was also dating a photographer. So one night she's hanging out with her photographer boyfriend and he's looking through these cards and he sees one of the names on the cards and he's like, oh my God, Marla, like, this is the real deal. You need to contact this guy, or you at least need to get a portfolio together, and you need to start actually trying to book jobs because I think you really have potential to be a model. So Marla knows she's not tall enough. They want the 6 foot supermodels at this point, New York City, the 80s. But she gets signed to a modeling agency called the Petite Modeling Agency. So this is where she would do ads like JCPenney, Mademoiselle, Glamour. And through this modeling work, she meets Steve Roth. He is a 27-year-old makeup artist, and he usually does makeup work for TV. So let me give you a little example of one of the first conversations that Marla ever has with Steve, this makeup artist. So he's telling her that she should never shave her legs, that she should definitely be waxing because waxing was becoming huge at this point. And Marla says, I just thought that he was a sleazo hanging around all of the models. Then he looks right at her and he says, how would you feel about having my face between your legs? Telling her that he could shave her bikini line for her. And Marla said back to him, I would find that disgusting, actually. So surprise, surprise, this makeup artist in New York City who loves to hit on models, he rents out an apartment to aspiring models, to young women who are in the city and they're just trying to establish themselves as models. Of course, Marla is excited about this at first. She agrees to move in. She met with the other models. They're awesome. She's getting along with them. Her rent's only $600 in the city, but that did not last long. Now, she loved everything else about this apartment except for Steve Roth. He was creepy as fuck. He would not leave Marla alone, constantly flirting with her, constantly asking her out. And he would come into the apartment all the time, unannounced, because he had the key to get in, obviously. So he was just always showing up. And this all just was way too much for Marla to handle. So she ends up finding a different apartment and she tells Steve, I'm going to move out. Of course, Steve Roth loses his damn mind. And Marla was moving into a different apartment in the same building. So that made him even more pissed off. He came rushing over to the apartment and he just raged out on Marla. One of the roommates at the time said that Marla looked like a scared rabbit. So she threatens to sue Steve for her $850 deposit because he's saying he's not going to give it back to her. She said that she was also going to report him because Steve was illegally subletting this apartment. So Steve says, okay, I'll give you your money back, but you got to meet me at the bar. He says there's this bar named Shutters. He just wants to meet up with Marla, talk to her a little bit, you know, squash this whole situation, and she'll get her money back. But this is June 4th, 1986. So on this night, Marla actually had a hair appointment, and she's friends with her hairdresser, as we all are. Hello, Kristen. You rule. And so they do her hair. They highlight her hair. The haircut is done. It's the end of the night. The salon's closing down. So they open a bottle of champagne and they all hang out in the salon and they just chat for a little bit. And Marla starts telling the hairdresser that she is just having all of this trouble with her ex-landlord. He is harassing her. He is being an asshole. And now she's got to go to this bar and meet him. And her hairdresser's like, girl, let me come with you. You guys know how it is. Like when I get my hair done, I almost feel like I'm going to my therapy session. And I always feel guilty when I'm leaving that I just like talked my hairdresser's ear off. But, you know, as all of our hairdressers would, her hairdresser is like, I'm going with you. You're not going alone. But Marla says no. She's like, no, it's okay. We're meeting in a public bar and it's going to be fine. But I will tell you, if I do end up in a ditch somewhere, you know who did it. So Marla meets Steve at Shutters and she says, you know what? It's pretty crowded. And they sit there and they talk somewhat civilly for a little bit. And he tells her that he's going to give her back her money. This is for sure, you know, but it's too much money. He can't be walking around with $850 in cash in his pocket. So he had half. He's telling her he has $425 in his pocket and it's all cash. He wants to give it to her, but he cannot give it to her in this crowded ass bar because it's dangerous and somebody's gonna see. So he's like, let's just step outside. And at first she's a little like, I don't know, but she thinks, okay, there's a lot of people standing outside. There's a police station like right within view. It's a neighborhood police station. So she goes outside with him thinking, you know, he's not gonna try anything. Marla had that gut feeling though. She could feel it. Something was wrong. He keeps glancing over his shoulder. He's turning around a lot, but then he's looking over her shoulder and it's really dark. And she's like, what the fuck is he looking at? So she turns around to look over at what he's looking at. And as she turns around, that is when she sees the two men. And these two men seem to be following them. And the minute she saw these two guys, she knew it. She knew that something was off. And Marla says that the minute she felt like something was off, she started panicking inside of her head. She didn't know if she should run or scream. You know, her fight or flight or freeze is all taking over. And that's what we talk about here on Residue. And that's what stay paranoid means. Because when I was young, probably around 12, I watched an Oprah episode where she said, at least if you prepare yourself mentally in your head for these situations, just think about them. Just think, what would happen if I was walking out of the mall and someone walked up to me and said, get in the car, and pointed to their car and they had a gun. What would you do? Just think about it, because at least when, and not when, hopefully never, hopefully at least never when this happens to you, your brain kind of already knows that we've discussed this is a possibility in life. So that's what Marla was thinking. She was like, okay, she's remembering all these TV shows in her head, all of these scary TV shows where the people are assaulted. And she thinks, I don't know what to do. She's just panicking. And then she thinks, no, I'm just being crazy. You know, that thought we always have, like we second guess our instincts. We should never do that. But God, it happens so easily in these situations because we are just taught to never make anyone else feel uncomfortable. Even though we feel uncomfortable and we're getting all these red flags, we're still like, no, I don't want to rush to any conclusions. So she doesn't trust her gut in that moment. But then Marla starts to remember that Steve has been acting weird this whole night. She just didn't really pick up on it. She remembers walking into the bar and the way he was nervous and sweaty, and he didn't look like himself. And that is when she looked back at those guys and she thought, these guys are going to try to kill or rape me. In Texas Monthly from 1993, Marla is quoted as saying, I don't know what comes over you. It's almost a calmness, like shock. Like, I should have seen what was going on. I started looking around to see how I could get out of it, but then the two guys just ran up on me, caught me. They were pushing me through the parking lot. She says, it's a strange experience. It's like you're off somewhere watching yourself. You're not in your own body. I just resigned myself to the fact that I might die. Marla remembers that she could just see Steve standing underneath a streetlight, and he was acting like he didn't even know her, like he didn't know this whole situation. He's not a part of it. And she says that she kept thinking in her head that she didn't want to be raped, no matter what. So she stood up tall against this fence, as tall as she could stand up against a fence, and she thought, I'm probably going to die. I just don't want to be raped. And it's hard to rape somebody who is standing up. These are thoughts that are going through her head while she's just in panic mode. Marla describes the attack to the New York Times. Once the men got a hold of her, she said that their hands went straight to her face and they pushed her down. She said she felt a stinging. And she thought at first that they were spraying something into her eyes or her face. The taller man started moving his hands back and forth for a minute and a half. It kept continuing. It seemed like forever. She said she started to scream, or that she felt like she was screaming, and she just started to run. She started running towards the light and she ran back into the bar. And when she gets in the bar, she's screaming. She's holding her face and people are running up to her. Somebody gives her towels to hold on her bleeding face. She's not even really aware she's bleeding right now. She's just in, you know, survival mode. And they tell her to sit down when she gets into the bar. They tell her to just breathe. And they say, do not look in the mirror. Marla knows she has to get to a hospital. She's sitting in the bar and the bartender says, who did this to you? Oh my God. And Marla tells her Steve Roth, but the bartender looks at her like, no, there is no way that Steve Roth would do something like this. That is the moment while she is waiting for an ambulance that Marla thinks, oh my God, this is going to be my word against his. Luckily, it only took a few minutes before cops stop two black men running down the street in blood-stained clothes, and they arrest them. They take them in to the police station, but before they're even going to take Marla to the hospital, they want her to come in and identify the men. So she does, and she identifies them twice. This is 19-year-old Darren Norman and 26-year-old Stephen Bowman. These are the two men that attacked Marla in the street that night. Darren Norman is very quickly identified as the man that was actually holding the razor blade and slicing at Marla's face. He was 19 years old. And then the other man, Stephen Bowman, that dude immediately tells police that, yo, Stephen Roth had everything to do with this. Stephen Roth set this up. Police already suspect Steve Roth because Steve Roth is an idiot. He's jumping into the police car with Marla when they're taking her down to the police station. Now, he's telling so many different stories. He says that he is Marla's fiance. He must go with her. And then he says, no, no, no. I'm a victim. I was robbed by these guys. I'm also a victim. So cops were already like, this guy is full of shit. And he was already arrested and in jail by the morning. So all three men are charged with first-degree assault. As these guys are being booked, Marla is in surgery, and she wakes up in a hospital room to a life that she never expected. This assault left Marla with three wounds on her face that required surgery and over 150 stitches. Just an absolutely horrifying way to wake up. She gets out of surgery. She's in this hospital room, and she says that her phone was constantly ringing. You know, people are trying to check up on her. It's the 80s. We didn't have cell phones. Now, her doctor is telling her, stop. You cannot be talking on the phone. Do you understand that your muscles are in your face and you can't be moving your face? You have to be lying flat on your back. You can't talk. So the doctor unplugs her phone and the nurses come in and they're yelling at her because now her friends, her family, they're calling the front desk because her phone isn't working in her room because her doctor unplugged it. And the nurses are like, we're not your answering service, okay? We're not equipped for this. You've got to plug in your phone because her phone is ringing nonstop. It's not just friends and family. It's reporters. It's a TV journalist was constantly calling her. People wanted to obviously immediately jump on this story, and Amarla was not mentally or physically prepared to handle all of this attention. Marla ended up giving an interview to one reporter because he kept bothering her. And she's like, fine, let's do it. But this angered so many other media people that she finally was like, okay, let's do a press conference. It's like, dude, leave the girl alone. So the public is just in love with Marla. They want to help. They want to know how she is. They want to make sure she's okay. And she didn't have any money. So she's in this private room. She didn't know how she was going to pay for this hospital visit, for this room. And she gets a phone call from this secretary. And she says that she works for this man named Milton Petrie. He's a philanthropist. He wrote Marla a check for $20,000 because he wanted her to be able to cover her medical expenses. She didn't even know this man. So she tries to decline this. And the secretary's like, Marla, girl, listen. This dude has so much money. He has millions. His wife would spend more than this on one dress. So take the money. So things like this were happening to Marla, but also during this time of compassion from the public, there was also a lot of oddness. Things were being said to Marla that she didn't really understand. And a lot of this was coming from her old friends. And this is before the internet. So these people are saying this to her face after this attack. Now she has old friends saying to her, this is your karma. Like, for what? Somebody said to her, I knew something like this would happen if you moved to New York City. So she's starting to think that somehow this is her fault. And now she even gets a phone call from someone that she didn't know, but she lived in Dallas, as Marla had. And this woman said, you don't know me, but we're very concerned about you down here. Honey, whatever you've done, God will forgive you. You may have strayed off the path of righteousness, but that's okay. We all get a second chance. And Marla's starting to think, what the fuck do you mean God will forgive me? I have not done anything. So Marla actually says to this woman, fuck you, and hangs up the phone. So everything starts moving very quickly. And by the time Marla's even out of the hospital, it's 5 days later. And the trial of the three men is already starting. So the first trial is Stephen Roth. This was going to be a hard trial because everything was circumstantial, but he hurt his own case. So Steve Roth has already been known to tell many different stories. He tells a new story. He says that Stephen Bowman, the 26-year-old attacker, he's been having an affair with Steve Roth. Now, these two have been in a relationship that no one knew about, and Steve Roth decides it's time to break it off with Steve Bowman. But Steve Bowman gets pretty pissed off, and he assumes that it's because Steve Roth is now dating or engaged to Marla Hansen, and that Bowman created this entire attack on Marla out of jealousy. Steve Roth had absolutely nothing to do with it. But nobody buys this, and Steve Roth is convicted very quickly, like immediately found guilty, and he is convicted on December 20th, 1986. But Steve Roth is not going to be sentenced until after the trial of the two attackers. Steve Roth's defense attorney was very kind to Marla on the stand compared to the way she is about to be treated when the trial of Norman and Bowman begins. Stephen Bowman's attorney was named Alton Maddox Jr. Now, I want to read to you his opening statement. He said, "I will tell you about a woman named Marla Hansen who was after every man in the city, a woman who preyed on men and their relationships with women. Marla Hansen, a girl out of Texas, has a lot of racial hang-ups. As she walked up the street, just the simple act of seeing two black men walking, saying nothing to her, acting in the fashion of any civilized men, she went absolutely nuts. Immediately, she began to think she was about to be raped and immediately began to think about the fear of black men she had brought from Texas." You know, just victim blaming the entire trial. And you know, it wasn't just Alton Maddox Jr. who was victim blaming. The judge got in on this. The judge on this case was Jeffrey Atlas. And at one point during the trial, he says that Marla's alleged flirting with, quote, other women's men might be considered improper, low even. I mean, I'm dumbfounded. This woman was completely disfigured. I don't give a shit if she was flirting with every single woman's man in that room. You don't get to do that. So this judge allows Stephen Bowman's lawyer to call Marla's credibility into question during this entire trial. He allows things like, okay, Steve Roth, he said that Marla is a cunt. And the judge said, okay, yeah, I'll allow that. Let's allow that. What? Like, I'm raging right now. And okay, I know some people don't like when I swear, and you probably hate that word. So just like, you know how much you just hated hearing that word in this little episode here? Imagine being called that in front of a room full of men and a jury, and you just had your face slashed, needed 150 stitches, and you're being called that word. At one point in this trial, the lawyer referred to Hansen as that lying bitch, and then he mocked the fact that Marla thought they were going to rape her. He's mocking her for thinking that that was going to happen during the attack. It's all so disgusting. And Marla is just humiliated during this entire trial. She says that she looks to the judge like, can you help me? And he didn't care at all. She was completely alone. Now she is being re-victimized by the legal system. But the judge ends up convicting all three men. All three men are found guilty, and all three men are sentenced to 5 to 15 years in jail. After the trials, after all of that part of her story was over, Marla just, she hit rock bottom. She sold the rights to her story, which became the television movie, The Marla Hansen Story. It is also called Face Value. And actually, that man, Milton Petrie, he set up a trust fund for Marla, and it was designed to pay her $20,000 a year for life. And I mean, at this point, Marla has hit a certain level of celebrity. You know, she's being asked to all the coolest parties. She's meeting all of the coolest celebrities, but that does not change the fact that she's scarred, not just on her face, but emotionally. It took a while for Marla to seek psychological help, to talk to a therapist, and when she did, she was told that she is going to need to regain control over her life, or she is not going to end up in a good place. This is when Marla decides, you know what? I'm going to go back to school. I'm going to study film. Marla Hansen has dedicated her career to advocacy. As a screenwriter, she worked on series like The Blackout, 1997, and Subway Stories, 1997. She also had Gina Gershon offer to play the lead role in one of her movies. Leonard Cohen wrote some music for one of her movies. And also one of Spike Lee's editors worked on her films. After everything died down, Marla got married and she had a daughter, and she focused solely on her daughter and her family for decades. She took a step back from modeling. She just felt like she didn't want to be in her own skin, in her own body. She said that she started meditating and that healed her. It was her daughter, who was now in college, that really pushed her to step into the next chapter of her life. And her daughter was 21 at the time and said, "Mom, I think you should go on this show on Netflix." And Marla agreed because, in her words, she just wanted to look and feel better. Marla appeared on season 3 of Netflix's Skin Decision, Before and After. At age 59, she underwent a series of non-invasive cosmetic procedures like liquid facelifts, fillers, Botox, microneedling, and laser resurfacing. This was under the care of Nurse Jamie and Dr. Sheila Nazarian. You should really check out this episode because you can just watching Marla speak and just watching her move, she's just got such a great aura. And if you are a woman in the perimenopause, menopause stage of life, Marla's 59 in this episode, and she does talk about how as we age, our bodies just, they get away from us. Everything's different. You feel like a different person. And she was just trying to regain control again. I will leave you with something that Marla said after she felt like her confidence returned. "Looking in the mirror today, I see a new Marla. My face is more youthful, even-toned. Your story is never over. There is always another chapter you can write." Thank you so much for joining me again this week on Residue. And don't forget to stay safe and stay paranoid. Stay paranoid. My main source for today's episode is an article in Texas Monthly titled "Scarred" by Jan Reed, published January 1993. And also the made-for-television film, The Marla Hanson Story, 1991. All other sources are listed in the show notes.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.